recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey, everybody. Thanks again for stopping by the Infamous Indie Podcast to listen to another episode. My apologies for being a day late. You know, I like to put them out on Mondays every other week. Well, this week, it just got away from me, and I needed the extra day. So this week, I do want to remember the victims of domestic violence. If you or a loved one think that you're being abused, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Their advocates are available 24/7 in 200 languages. All the calls are free and confidential. 1-800-799-SAFE. Again, 1-800-799-7233. This story is about Heather Norris, a woman who was abused and killed by her boyfriend after they were dating on and off for a few years. There were signs she could have been helped, but unfortunately, no one stepped up. She was young and pretty and did not deserve what happened to her. On September 5th, 2008, her murderer, 24-year-old Joshua Beans, was sentenced to 65 years behind bars after admitting to killing his ex-girlfriend and then using trash bags in the home to dump her body around Indianapolis. A jury did convict Bean for murder and abuse of a corpse. At the trial, Bean's attorney tried to argue that he killed Norris out of self-defense, but prosecutors said her murder followed months of domestic abuse. Detectives say around April 10, 2007, Bean murdered Heather at the Irvington home. Then Bean burned, mutilated, and disposed of her body. During the questioning, he told detectives that he loved Heather, but reportedly emailed friends about hating her. Investigators did find evidence of the crime at the home, but none of Heather's remains. He then used his new roommates after killing Heather to help clean up his terrible crime, the details of which are all part of a new book by Crystal O'Keefe. O'Keefe lived with Joshua Bean when he murdered the 20-year-old Heather Norris. O'Keefe and her boyfriend moved in with Bean about a week after the murder. The book entitled The Murderer Across the Hall details the steps that he took to cover up the murder and the dismemberment that took place in the home's basement and even evidence they discovered after moving in. This week, I sit down with Crystal to hear her perspective from across the hall. She tells me exactly what happened and all the pain and growth that she's gone through since Heather's murder. 100% of the proceeds from that book go to three different charities: Heather's Voice, Domestic Violence Network, and the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. If you so choose, get that book, read it, and know that that money is going to help real people.
I know your secret, I know the truth. I know your secrets and I'm telling on you.
Hi, I'm Alicia.
I'm Allie.
I'm Danny.
And I'm Amy.
And together we're the Cold Case Chronicles.
Come hang out with us as we investigate unsolved crimes from across Indiana.
We're sort of like The View, but with murder.
Except we're funny and not political. Oh, and with some explicit language.
Cold Case Chronicles can be heard on your favorite podcast app or by visiting coldcasechronicles.com. And as always,
have the day you deserve.
Especially if you're a murderer.
I know your secrets and I'm telling on you.
I just want to take some time to talk about my friends over at the Cold Case Chronicles podcast and the Circle City Crime podcast before we start this interview portion of my podcast. In a special episode out right now, Chris from 3C's podcast and Amy from Cold Case Chronicles talked to someone infamous indie fans should know very well, Kelsey German. She was my first ever interview, and here is a clip of their episode.
You know, you almost feel bad asking her to come on and talk about it, but at the same time, you know what she's trying to accomplish. And again, from talking to her now, the focus in what she's trying to do, and to hear that she wants to get off of social media. I mean, she's not doing this for personal attention or personal gain of any kind. This is a labor of love. This is a focused effort, and wish her the best and hope it comes soon.
The episode highlights the most recent released evidence in the unsolved murder of Libby German and Abigail Williams, and then it concludes with a heart-wrenching discussion with Kelsey German. Now, on to this week's episode with Crystal O'Keefe. Enjoy.
Hey everybody, welcome to the interview portion of the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo, and sitting across from me in my kitchen is an author, newly a published author, mm-hmm. Crystal O'Keefe. And Crystal, you were a witness to the murder of Heather Norris.
Yes.
Thank you for joining me today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've been able to talk just a little bit about where you come from and kind of why you decided to write the book. Let's go over that for my listeners. I think it's really interesting, but you're also kind of one of us in the sense that you started reading or liking true crime even, after the murder, but also before. You were younger, you were reading stuff like this. Tell people why you wanted to write this book, excuse me.
So I really wanted to get... I really just kind of wanted to get all of this off my chest. I wanted a chance to heal from the experience. I spent the last 12 years in therapy, even just recovering from this. So I wanted a chance to get all of these thoughts and fears and all of these things I told my therapist for so many years out there, while also raising awareness about domestic violence, about a domestic homicide, and what I went through, what I saw the family go through, and just how hard it is to live through that experience. And I really felt like it was my time to get this out there. I felt like if I didn't do it now and I didn't just almost immediately publish that book, I would never do it. And then I couldn't say I was an advocate against domestic violence.
You have worked for nonprofits before, and specifically the Society of Journalists?
Professional Journalists,
which is an organization that I should know. And part of that is being able to tell your side truthfully. Did you find it hard to remember a lot of the stuff you went through back then when you were writing the book?
I did.
And what's the name of the book, by the way?
The book is called The Murderer Across the Hall.
A Murderer Across the Hall.
And then I did find it really hard. A lot of things I had repressed, and it took me rereading my witness statement to kind of refresh my mind a little bit on what had happened and what people's names were and kind of the time period, because a lot of that you try to forget. You don't want to remember the details. You don't want to remember all of your feelings during that. So it took a lot of nights of me pausing and rereading this witness statement and trying to remember these things so I could get it right, so I could get the story correct, I could get my feelings right down on paper again. So it was reliving a lot of it.
That must be very difficult.
It was. It was a lot of nights where I would sit in bed after my kids went to sleep and I would read this, until midnight, and I'm like, why did I do this? This is going to give me nightmares again. But
did you ever have nightmares from it?
I did, actually. Right after it was published, I started having these crazy nightmares and really bad anxiety of like, oh my gosh, what if these people that I never want to connect with again see this? And then it was just, again, reliving these details and reliving the things that you saw right there, fresh in your brain, prone to nightmares.
You are very strong.
Thank you.
For doing that. But what I find really interesting about when someone like you writes a book or a witness writes a book, it is only one perspective. But did the family agree, Heather Norris's family, kind of help you along or agree to help you?
Heather's family and friends have been incredibly supportive since day one, since the trial even, and this has been almost 13 years now. I reached out to her mom before I even submitted the book, and I said, hey, I am writing this book about my experience, about being a witness, about living with him in that same house and what I went through. And I've been told by my therapist and my husband that this would be a good thing to write about. And we talked for a little while, and she was okay with it, and she had supported it. She told all of her friends and family members about the book, so they have been incredible. Her mom is just the sweetest. She's an angel, and, you know, she obviously went through the worst of it. Her family really suffered from this. They lost, you know, an only child, the light of their life, and for her to be so supportive of me rehashing some of these details while still trying to be sensitive to Heather, to the subject of the whole book, was just an incredible relief. So I made sure that she was okay with me even putting this out into the world before I sent it anywhere to be published.
What is... let's go over, because I'd like to go back now at this point to talk about what you do remember, what you talk about in your book, and then we'll go from there, and we'll just kind of continue to have a conversation. You know, you seem really comfortable talking about this, and that's amazing, because domestic violence is everywhere, and we have to be able to recognize it and help people and let them know that there's a space, and I can see you just being a straight-up great advocate for that. It all started when you were trying to move away from an apartment. You and your boyfriend at the time just couldn't live in this really shitty apartment.
Yes.
And you were like, all right, we got to move. And he met somebody.
So, yeah, my boyfriend at the time knew Josh from high school. They had known each other for a while. I'm not sure how exactly they kind of reconnected, but I know their families also lived close to each other. So it could have just been that. And he had just purchased a house in Irvington and had contacted my boyfriend and said, hey, we can split the rent. This would be awesome. You guys should move in. And, you know, they talked and they seemed really excited about it. And I thought, hey, this apartment really sucks. Maybe it's at least worth going to check out. So off we went to meet him at his house in Irvington.
Right. And that is Josh.
Yes, that was Josh that we went to meet.
Yeah. In the book, when someone reads it, the names are different.
Yes, I did change the names because there are a few people kind of like my ex and like Josh that obviously don't want to go and say, hey, I'm going to write this book. Can I include your names? Because those are two people that I don't.
So it's part of a it's almost a legal reason why you didn't include their names. You're not hiding the fact that these people are who they are.
No. And if you're from, especially if you're from Irvington or just Indiana in general, you're probably familiar with the case. It was a very horrific case. So I think a lot of people knew what it was to start, but for legal reasons and me not wanting to open some new wounds,
sure,
I changed the names.
You describe what Josh looked like the moment you walked in. Was it an immediate abrasive feeling or just, you just don't know the guy?
I didn't know him. I knew absolutely nothing about him. I walked into this kind of super cramped tiny kitchen and he was just right there. Tall, kind of pasty guy with really dark, greasy hair, greasy skin. Just, you know, I didn't know him. I didn't immediately think, oh, we're going to be best of friends. Just kind of this indifferent, but not fully excited kind of feeling.
And then that's when you first walked around the house.
Yeah, that was the first time we got into the house. This was March 2007.
What did you notice about the house? I mean, Irvington in 2007 was a little different than it is in 2019.
Yeah.
But still similar neighborhood and similar housing, obviously.
Yeah, a nice neighborhood. I grew up right by Irvington, so I went to, you know, Little Flower. So, you know, east side, kind of quiet, nice community. So the house, I mean, the house was a tiny house, but it was cute. It needed decorated. It was very much a kind of bachelor pad at the time. But, you know, I thought, well, this is a nice, safe neighborhood. So I didn't mind the idea of possibly living there.
And then you moved in. And, you know, a deal was made between you and your ex and this guy, Josh. And you're like, you know what? It's better. It's an upgrade in my house. It sounds like we're going to save a little bit on rent because we get to split it three ways. Mm-hmm. And here we go. Now we're in. So you moved in. And what was maybe something that you remember after moving in that you talk about in your book or now?
So we had moved in after the murder had happened. We were starting to get ready to pack, and my ex's mom was in town the weekend it actually happened. Mm-hmm. We were trying to get in the house. We couldn't get a hold of Josh. And so we just kind of gave up on the idea. We even tried to drive by the house, and nobody, like, we didn't see his car, so we couldn't get in. So we finally got a hold of him around April, I want to say about April 15th. Mm-hmm. And he'd said, oh, sorry, I had this big party over the weekend, but just really rowdy people were at the house, and there was some damage to the basement done. You know, my stairs caught on fire. The basement stairs caught on fire. Someone threw a lit cigarette in this trash, and just a rowdy group. Sorry I wasn't around. And April 17th was the first time we actually got back into that house, and this was the week after he had killed her. Hmm. And so we kind of get in, and it was strange. He had told us, you know, there was a lot of smoke damage in the basement. He was going to have to replace the carpet. So we were like, well, can we get in? Can we maybe paint over, like start working on getting this fixed? Because we were planning to move in less than 2 weeks at this point. We were, you know, the beginning of May was when we were kind of scheduled, our lease was up, and we were going to be ready. So we get into the house, and the carpet around the stairs had been ripped up. There was all this damage on the walls. There was a bathroom downstairs in the basement with a jacuzzi tub, and I kind of had peered in and noticed that he had started painting the walls black for no reason, and then outside, the garage windows had been painted white, like they had been painted over so you couldn't see into the garage anymore. And we thought, well, this is weird. He must have had some party. I don't know what these people did. And we were kind of angry because we went and bought paint and primer to fix everything. We're like, well, can we get refunded for this? This isn't cheap. And he was like, no, these people are never going to be around again. I don't want them back in the house. I can't get in contact with them. And at that point, my ex found what was Heather's car in the garage, too. So we kind of had this weird feeling and, you know, is this going to happen all the time? We're not signing up for these rowdy parties where they damage the basement. But again, we were like, you know what? It's fine. He said these people are never going to be around again. Maybe this isn't something that we actually have to worry about. So... but it was definitely an uneasy feeling after that, walking into that house and trying to fix all of this damage.
I've never heard of someone doing this where they murder someone and then they have their new tenants help clean it up.
Yeah, that was new to us. We unknowingly painted over all this smoke damage that had ended up being his attempt to dispose of Heather in a way. He tried to burn her.
Let's go back a little bit to if you've ever met Heather. Just explain to people.
Yeah. Heather and I had never actually met. We were the same age, same class. She had reached out over MySpace and sent a message. She said, hey, I'm Bean's girlfriend. I can't wait to meet you guys. I heard you're moving in. This is really exciting. This happened about a week before she had went missing, because for all we knew at that time, well, after the fact that she had been missing. So she had just reached out, and I said, oh, this is cool. You know, I think I even had sent her a friend request on MySpace at the time. So I thought, this girl is my age. She seems really cool. hopefully we get along. Like, I was looking at her page and I was like, oh, she likes Invader Zim. This is really cool. Nobody else likes that. But so yeah, I was hoping for a friendship with her.
And that's the last time you contacted her?
Yeah.
Or she contacted
you? That was the last time we heard anything from her.
Did you know that was Heather's car right away in that garage sitting there?
We didn't know. Mm-hmm. My ex had asked, and Josh would only refer to her as really derogatory terms. And, you know, he said, oh, that bitch, she left it. She was drunk. She had to have somebody come pick her up. She'll be back to get it, but no one else is ever going to be back. But she'll get her car eventually.
Very eerie, even as you're saying it here. It's very odd. And, you know, you just didn't know, right?
No, I mean, was 19. I was super naive. I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. You eventually did move in. You helped paint over this terrible tragedy.
Yeah.
You literally are painting it over. Mm-hmm. What happened next? When was the moment that everything changed from you being naive to, holy shit, I'm in the middle of a murder mystery?
It still took a while. Josh started getting even weirder than he already was. He was high a lot. He smoked pot. He was drinking. He was never leaving the basement unless he was going to work. Like, he put a futon down in the basement and slept by his computer down in the basement. Wouldn't leave it. And we noticed he was really angry a lot more. And still, we were like, what is this guy's deal? So it got to the point where I was trying to get out of the house as much as possible. My boyfriend worked nights, so he didn't get home until 2 o'clock in the morning. So a lot of times it was just me and Josh alone in this house, me hiding upstairs or trying to leave or trying to get friends to come over and just kind of be there. And I still had no idea. And then there was a weekend where he just kind of ran off. We were actually celebrating two birthdays, my ex and one of my best friends. Their birthdays were days apart. So we told him, we're like, hey, we're going to have people over. There's, you know, cake and whatever, just a party for both of them. And he was gone. We couldn't get a hold of him at any point. His phone was off the entire weekend. And his dad came over Monday morning, pounding on our doors saying, where is Josh? Have you heard from Josh? What is going on? He's not answering my phone. And we were like, hey, we haven't heard anything either. And finally he got a hold of us and said, hey, there were these white vans outside the house a couple days ago. I think someone turned me in saying I'm growing pot in the basement. And we're like, excuse, like, seriously, this is what you're doing in our house? And he was like, so I just left. I'm going to go to Chicago. We're going to go to this concert. And so we said, okay, you know, whatever. And then we get another kind of frantic call from him saying they took his work computer and that Heather is missing. That was all.
From him?
Yes.
You got that call from him?
We did.
So the first time you hear Heather's missing is from Josh himself?
Yeah. So we kind of freak out, you know, we're like, what's going on? And I came home from work one night and the crime lab vans were at my house searching the entire house, wouldn't even let me go inside, questioned who I was, kind of grilled me for a little bit and said, you know, you can't be here. This is an investigation. And I called my boyfriend and I was like, hey, just an FYI, there's a crime lab at our house. I don't know what's going on. They're not telling me anything. They're not letting me inside. Mm. And we were actually going out of town that weekend, actually that following day, because this was a Thursday night. We were going out of town to visit his family and go to a wedding. And they wouldn't even let us in until the next day to even get our stuff. And we had to be careful of what we even took because they were investigating inside the house.
So I would say the crime lab was probably the biggest key for you.
Yeah, it was. and then finally talking to the detective the next day, And then she, you know, told us, please give us your phone numbers. We need to have an open line of communication with both of you just in case anything happens. And we actually got all the way down to Vincennes, where my boyfriend's family lives.
Sure.
And we were at dinner when we got the call from the detective. And she said, Joshua Bean is in the homicide unit. And at that moment, it just, I couldn't even describe what I was thinking in that moment of what happened. What happened in our house? Why are these people here? You know, why is our house now on the news? I think that was the most surreal moment, is seeing a reporter standing outside of your house on live news channels saying Joshua Bean killed Heather Norris in their house and in Irvington. And this whole time, we had no idea.
Mm.
We didn't even know the details of it yet. We found out all those details later that night, but we had no idea. And we,
from
we
the
should
news.
Have known.
You yeah. probably heard it from
We heard some details
or?
From the news, and then we had heard some details from Josh's family, because my boyfriend and his family had lived close to each other. Mm-hmm. So he had actually confessed to his dad and his uncle, and we heard from them all of the details from the murder.
And then all of a sudden the fire makes sense.
The fire made sense. He had all of these like scratches on his hands, and he had gotten stitches, and he had told us someone had jumped him when he was checking the mail at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, oh my gosh, no. Now I know why he had stitches. Now I know why the basement was on fire. Now I know why it was painted black in the bathroom, why the car was in the garage. Like, everything came together. And the more we thought about things, the more we were like, oh my gosh, we helped do this. We helped paint.
But you know you didn't.
No. But there was
through
still...
Through years of therapy.
There's still, to this day, is a lot of survivor's guilt and a lot of just, oh my gosh, I helped cover this murder up unknowingly. And it was traumatic. And I, even testifying, I was like, I'm not in trouble, am I? I didn't do anything. You know, this was not my idea.
You were
I
a
was,
victim of manipulation,
yeah,
which is something
exactly.
he was pretty good at, from
yeah,
what people
very
say.
Very good at.
Right. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yeah,
I mean,
it's,
what a
it's
horrible
a
thing to live through. And you did it. You lived through it. And you came out here on the other side, and we're trying to help people.
Yeah.
Kind of want to talk about that manipulation, abusive behavior, because I'd like to start talking about the domestic violence aspect of this.
Mm-hmm.
did you see any of that from your perspective, other than the derogatory nature he would call his girlfriend, Heather?
He was rude to me, certainly, because I did not like to be around him. Mm. He'd always call me antisocial or a bitch, or he'd say something to my ex and like, God, your girlfriend, she's awful. Why doesn't she ever want to come down here? Why
like
does she
in front
talk
of your
us?
Face?
Yeah. I was...
I mean, and I'm sure you could probably hear what
yeah.
he was saying. Okay.
No, he, in front of me one time, because I didn't want to stay downstairs in the basement and play couples pool because he had some random girl over. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. I'm really tired. Like, you're smoking. I don't want to be around this. And he was like, why are you such an antisocial bitch, Crystal? And I said, I'm out. Like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to a friend's house or something. I can't be around you when you're like this. And he was. He was super rude. He never had anything nice to say about women. He was just, I mean, they were just toys to him.
Mm.
So he was incredibly manipulative and always super rude to us.
And then your boyfriend at the time, what it now, you know, I don't know how much you've spoken to him or how much he's in the book, but in general, what was his take after that moment that it happened?
Because
you guys are at dinner at a wedding. Is that right? Is that what you're
saying?
Well,
we were at dinner. We had had a wedding earlier that day.
Okay.
And then when we found out that he was being held in the homicide unit, we were at dinner, out to eat at some restaurant down in Vincennes. And I think we were both just in this crazy state of shock that this could happen. We knew he was kind of a jerk. and we were just trying to make the best out of kind of a crappy situation, but we were both in shock that someone we knew could even do this, do something as horrible as he did.
I wouldn't say you knew him. I think you just were around
him. No, I don't think
we
did. No.
You said you were an early reader. It sounds like you're a relatively smart person.
Yeah.
I can assume.
I was in school for psychology at the time, of all things.
Well, right. Well, that's a perfect example.
Yeah.
What do you think? Because some people are saying, well, how would you not know? I'm not saying accusing you of not knowing, but how could you not know? You know, from someone might ask that here listening, like, God, Crystal, wouldn't you know? I mean, wouldn't it be so obvious this guy's painting things? I mean, we've listened to enough true crime. I'm sure.
I've listened to enough true crime. And honestly, you don't think that anyone that close to you is capable of doing something. You know, his bedroom was across the hall from ours. You don't think that the person that is right across the hall from you is capable of murdering someone and doing something so gruesome to another human. You want to think the best of people, even if you don't like them. I try to think you have some redeeming quality, even if I don't like you. And so you're just not capable, especially when you're so young. You know, again, I was 19 when it happened.
Yeah, you were 19.
I was 20 when I had to give my witness statement. You know, you're naive. You don't think this kind of thing could happen. You don't think this kind of thing could happen in this nice neighborhood that you're used to, that you would go trick-or-treating in as a kid. You know, you don't think these things can happen. Mm. And that's clearly not the reality. But, you know, I really didn't know. Mm. And I don't think my ex knew. We were just stunned.
I could only imagine that moment and just being like, oh my gosh, how would I be so naive not to realize?
Yeah.
Now, being 19, you probably didn't read all that much true crime before that you were...
Not as much as I do now,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. And then, you know, writing the book, you decided, you know, I feel like it was therapeutic and now it's coming out. And you can kind of come to terms with the fact that you didn't know. And that it's okay that you didn't know. Mm-hmm. And also, it kind of goes to the point of not knowing who someone really is and what's going on in a relationship. You know, domestic violence abuse perpetrators are some of the most cunning and deceptive human beings out there. And it's because they, God forbid, anybody finds out that they're this monster inside. You know, they have this control over this one person, and for Joshua, it was Heather. And so, what have you learned about domestic violence over the last 12 years about this? I mean, I think that's partly why this is so important to you.
Yeah, I've learned that it's everywhere, and there's so many different types of abuse. It could be... Sometimes it can just start as a mental abuse and it's controlling someone. I actually once dated a guy who said, you're not even the prettiest of your friend group. You're lucky that I'm with you. Who's going to date you after me? Like, it's something like that. They can just put you down. They can yell at you. They can humiliate you. They can control you through, you know, money, your bank account, and making it so that you can't leave. You know, if you're... God forbid, living with each other, and they're even just mentally abusing you, they will do every single thing they can to control you so that no one else can have you. So you can't be free of that person. And then it could be, you know, they're an alcoholic and maybe they got drunk and maybe they punched a wall, but it could very easily be you next time they're punching. You know, there's all these different forms of this abuse. And then it can lead to something physical, and it could lead to your death. You know, it happened in Heather's case. He had a pending charge against him for battery against Heather that he actually bragged about after she passed away, that she didn't bother showing up to court, so they dropped the charge against him.
Yeah, because, she didn't show up because she was gone.
She was dead. So how was she going to show up to these things? But that control was still there. So it's very much controlling and putting this person down and physically abusing them. And it's everywhere. And people most of the time don't know it because victims don't want to talk about it.
Why would they? They're going to lose everything and be embarrassed and say, oh, victim shaming. How dumb are you for staying with this person?
Yeah, it's similar to sexual assault. Victims are just not believed as much as they need to be. Of course, people will falsely say things, but that's so, so rare to this point where victims aren't being believed, victims aren't being helped. And because of that, we're seeing these homicides, these domestic homicides happening, and we're losing our loved ones because of it.
How do you think that Josh would, some with your background a little bit, do you think Josh would have killed again?
I really think
if he got away with it.
Yeah, I really think if he had gotten away with that and he felt like he could do it, he probably would. That seemed to fit how much of a narcissist he was.
Well, that's a big word on this podcast.
Yeah. he was a big narcissist.
And you live with it. How was that interview on Wish TV?
Oh my gosh. Thankfully Nina was so sweet because mm-hmm. I was so nervous. I hate watching myself being filmed like that. It was cringeworthy, but I felt good leaving, and I felt like we had really talked a lot about what Heather's, I mean, we talked a lot about Heather, we talked a lot about domestic violence, and we talked a lot about raising that awareness for it and what everybody goes through with it.
What should people do if they believe that someone's being in a domestic violence situation?
Thankfully, at this point, we have so many amazing resources. Domestic Violence Network, Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And we have plenty of other victims that have been through it. So if you really think that someone is going through it, you need to have that uncomfortable conversation. And you need to try to step in. You know, a lot of times these people won't feel safe and they won't tell people because, again, they think they're going to lose everything. But you almost need to intervene at this point. If you think your friend is going through it, you need to seek help for that person.
But Crystal, I can't do that because that'll embarrass her if I do that.
But you can temporarily embarrass that person, or you could lose them forever.
That makes it very clear that I need to help. thank you for that, because this is a huge thing, and I'm sure you know somebody who's been through domestic abuse, but you just don't know who they are.
Yeah.
Maybe be, you know, having them open up to you. We've covered the issue on this podcast a few times. It's sometimes they're very good at hiding. It's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any point where you just had a bad aura about him? Like, more so than the normal, like, this guy is really weird. You know, he's really greasy and creepy. I mean, I love that he's described as some greasy, like, weirdo.
Yeah, that's what he was.
Sleeps in his basement next to his computer. But was there any point where it was almost like you felt weird around him, even though you didn't have any suspicions?
Yeah, of course. Really, I didn't feel super comfortable even in the beginning. I didn't necessarily want him as my roommate, but again, it was make the most of it. There's got to be something good about this person. You know, my ex has known him forever. But even from that first time meeting him, I didn't get this great vibe from him. And I try very much to kind of go by that. If I don't feel like I have a good connection, or if you're putting off something kind of just different and weird that I don't like, I try not to even talk to you. Mm-hmm. And kind of from that first time I met him, I was like, I don't know about this guy. It's kind of weird. But I still moved in, obviously. But from that time, just, I never felt comfortable around him. I didn't want to hang out with him. He just seemed really weird. I refused to go down that basement. I wouldn't, like, our laundry machine was down there. And I would ask my ex, hey, will you go check on that laundry? Hey, will you, you know, oh, there's some cleaning supplies down in the basement. Will you go get them? Like, I didn't want to be down there we had that party, like, for my ex and my friend, and a lot of people were down in the basement, and a lot of people still said the same things. Like, people left early, and people had these weird vibes being down there. People that hadn't even met Josh didn't like being down there, and so it was just kind of this whole thing of, I'm just going to hang out in my room.
But and again, it's like, how do we stop these people? Like, that's what I come back to always. It's like, and that's why I bring people like you on this podcast. It's like, how do we stop it? What is it that can fucking put this stuff to an end? And, you know, see something, say something. Mm-hmm. Don't be wrong on your intuition. Heck, my wife has intuition on stuff, and it'll be 3 weeks before and it comes out. And I'm like, oh, you're absolutely right. You are 100% mm-hmm. correct. And so just kind of trust yourself and reach out to organizations that can help, and ultimately say something.
Yeah. See something, say something. If you've got a bad feeling in your gut and you think something is going on with your friend, your loved ones, anybody, do something, intervene. Because if we're not intervening and if we're not believing these victims, it's just going to continue. We want to break the cycle, but by not believing our victims and not putting these people away, it's just going to continue.
How important is it to have a voice? You, Heather's mom, and being able to let them have a voice, or let you have a voice. How important is that?
It's crucial, because a lot of people just don't know. I mean, people don't know the signs. People don't know what to look for. And I think, and Heather's mom does incredible. She goes around to different schools and talks about teen dating violence. So she is starting off young. She's starting off with these kids that are just coming into high school and saying to look out for these signs. And with me kind of getting this book out and going on, you know, being interviewed by you, by Nina, and getting out there and saying, this is what we need to look for. This is what we need to enter. This is when we need to intervene. I think it's helpful, and it's opened the conversation more so that everyone is talking about this now.
And Heather's mom, she goes around and talks about these to these kids, and I've read a couple articles on her doing that. And, you know, even to this day, she says she was a young girl. You know, she was 19, 18, 19 years old, 18 when she started dating Josh. Mm-hmm. So very naive and just built up on what she believed a relationship should be like. And, oh, I'm his girlfriend, so I need to act a certain way. You know, there are some people out there that say, you know, stay sexy, don't get murdered kind of deal. That personal safety is a little bit, but I think as a community, we need to have community safety awareness and not just personal safety awareness.
Yeah. Heather might not have known the signs, and because now what her mom is doing, she's making sure that others don't fall to this. She is saving lives by going around and doing this. I am saving lives by going on these, you know, your podcast, going on the news, putting this book out and saying, no, know these signs, know what to look for. This is not okay. This is not how you treat someone you love.
Murderer Across the Hall is the name of the book.
Yeah.
You did an incredible job.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You weren't nervous on this one.
No, I wasn't being recorded on the news this time around.
It's a little bit easier when we... Yes. And I really appreciate you speaking at length about your book and your experience. You can get it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. I just looked it up.
Yeah.
It's super easy.
It's a very quick read. It's a short story, so it takes 30 minutes. If you can stomach the content, it's a quick read.
Absolutely. Again, domestic violence is a huge issue. Thank you for bringing more awareness to it. You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Very strong. It's taken you a long time to write this book.
Yeah, very long time, but it's there now.
Wonderful. And then if anybody wants to help, you can obviously reach out to those organizations that Crystal was talking about, but also you can reach out to me and my podcast, and I can direct you to the right location. I say a lot of different things at the end of my podcast. I only say one thing, and I say I'd like you to say it, and I tell my viewers just to stay safe, and that's pretty much how I end it, and because it's a very clean statement, and I'd love for you to do it for me.
Yes, please stay safe.
All right, thank you, Crystal.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks again, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. I hope you learned something. A reminder again, the 100% of those proceeds from Crystal's book, The Murderer Across the Hall, go to three different charities: Heather's Voice, Domestic Violence Network, and Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. You can go to infamousindy.com. The links will be there. And I just want to say one more time that if there are people out there that need help, 1-800-799-SAFE. 1-800-799-SAFE. Just like that, the podcast is over. And I'll see you again next week. Stay safe.